We have two scriptures this morning. The first is from Matthew's Gospel, and the second comes from the book of Exodus. The Matthew reading is at chapter 22, beginning at verse 13. Make that verse 15. The Pharisees went and plotted to entrap Jesus in his own words. So they sent their disciples to Jesus along with the Herodians, saying, "Teacher, we know that you are sincere and teach the way of God in accordance with the truth and show deference to no one. For you do not regard people with partiality. Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to the emperor or not?" But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, "Why are you putting me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin used for the tax." And they brought him a denarius, and he said to them, "Whose head is this? Whose title?" And they answered, "Caesar's." And he said to them, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and render unto God the things that are God's." And when they heard this, they were amazed, and they left him and went away. Now hear these words from Exodus. This is chapter 33, beginning at verse 12. Moses said to the Lord, "See, you have said to me, 'Bring up this people,' but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you have said, 'I know you by name,' and you have also found favor in my sight. But if I have found favor in your sight, show me your ways so that I may know you and know that I have found favor in your sight. Consider too that this whole nation is your people." God said to Moses, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." And Moses said to God, "If your presence does not go, do not carry us up from here. For how shall it be known that I've found favor in your sight, I and your people, unless you go with us? For only in this way shall we be distinct, I and your people, from every other people on the face of the earth." And the Lord said to Moses, "I will do the very thing that you have asked, for you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name." Moses said, "So then show me your glory, I pray." And God said, "I will make all my goodness pass before you and will proclaim before you my name, the name of the Lord. And I will be gracious and I will show mercy." But God said, "Even you cannot see my face, for no one who is mortal can look on my face and live." And the Lord continued, "See, there is a place by me where you shall stand on the rock. And while my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. And then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back. But even to you, my face shall not be seen." Friends, this is the word of the Lord, and it can be trusted. Well, for its first few seasons, I was a great fan of the TV show Survivor. You guys know Survivor, right? Anybody watch Survivor as a guilty pleasure? Will it? You watch Survivor? I would not have guessed. Oh, all right. Yeah, there I was, right. If you don't know it or you don't remember it particularly well, in Survivor, a group of people from different ages and walks of life get plunked down somewhere beautiful but kind of tough to live in, at least at first, sort of an island or a remote stretch of coastline. And the premise of it is, of course, it's as if they are random occupants of a lifeboat that has made it to the relative safety of an uncharted island, and they need to find a way to make it work, build shelter, find food, prepare food, eat food. They don't even have fire to begin with for the most part. Eventually they do, then they got to gather the wood, the whole thing. Ultimately, of course, they must also find a way to survive one another, which is more about group dynamics than the physical hardship. But the hardship is central to the whole experience. When each season begins, the contestants are sort of dropped wherever they're dropped with only the clothes on their back. And as it happens, they also get to bring along one personal item, right? Some of you are nodding. You know about the personal item, right? Yeah. Okay. Actually, this morning, it's that personal item that's the thing I want to focus on. You may not remember, but the very first person voted off the show on the very first episode of season one was Sonia, a kind of physically frail person, as all of the people did in those first seasons. She had an incredible backstory, which we only just scratched the surface on because she was gone before you knew it, but she had been a cancer survivor and was coming out from the depth of that. Her hair was just beginning to grow back, and she decided that she wanted to do Survivor, which, good for her. Unfortunately, she lost the first challenge, and the group decided she was just going to be dead weight, so they voted her off. Her personal item, I remember, her personal item was a ukulele, which seemed sort of very her. The villain of that first season, they always try to kind of turn some person into the villain. The very first season, the first villain also became the eventual winner. His name was Richard, and his personal item was a little flint and some artificial kindling. Smart, right? Right? I mean, no wonder that he won, because he figured out that the guy who could make fire would be important to keep around at least for a little while, and that time would give him kind of important room to maneuver within the group, which he saw very clearly from before the first season even began was what the game was actually about. So he was the first person in the show to see that a contestant's personal item was in its way an important kind of currency. It was something to trade on, something to bargain with. And I suppose in its way, it also said something about him as a person, of course, just as surely as Sonia's ukulele said something about her. Sonia's vision, I think, of what was going to happen was that there would be some hard times, but they'd all pull together. Even if there wasn't a fire in the campfire, they would all be in the circle, and maybe the ukulele would kind of help them to bond, kind of take the pressure off somehow, lighten their spirits, which is a lovely thing to imagine. Richard was there to win the game. And who he was as a person didn't really factor into his calculations. Or, of course, maybe there's a possibility that, you know, who he was as a person was exactly revealed in that kind of calculating move that he made. Our gospel this morning also points out a kind of deeper calculation as revealed through what someone seems to have in their pocket. Matthew describes what may have been a kind of decisive confrontation between Jesus and the Pharisees, a moment shortly before they decide it's too dangerous to let Jesus speak, and probably, when you get right down to it, probably too dangerous to let him live. And the key moment in the story, which is one I think we've all heard plenty of times before, is this kind of gotcha moment where Jesus tells them, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and render unto God what is God's. And you've heard also he asks them to pull out a coin and to tell everyone whose face is on it, which they do. Caesar's, they say. Now, what you need to know is that at that time, to go in your pocket and fish out a denarius with Caesar's face on it would have been flashing the enemy's money. For the crowd who's also there, having Caesar in your pocket was to announce that when it came right down to it, Caesar pretty much had you in his pocket. Now, if the story had gone on for another line or two, maybe they would have tried to explain. Maybe they would have said, like it or not, Caesar's coins gave them room to maneuver. But as it happens, even so, that would have said almost everything anyone needed to know about their ultimate loyalties, about whom they were as people. And that's the point that Jesus wants to drive home. What are the loyalties that define us? Are there things that we are finally unwilling to trade away? Or are we people for whom everything is somehow up for negotiation? And that's actually some of what Moses is worried about in this morning's reading from Exodus. That needs a little more explanation, a little more background, so bear with me just a sec. This moment that you heard today occurs during the leadership of Moses and comes, as you've heard, from the book of Exodus. And it's sometime after Moses descends from the mountaintop and he's bearing the Ten Commandments. Well, you may not realize, if you haven't looked at the story particularly recently, the Ten Commandments turn out to be a flop upon delivery. The people have gotten scared while Moses was away receiving the commandments. In fact, they've gotten so scared that they turn not to God, but to symbols of God, they say, that they can see, that they can feel, that they can touch. And at first, you know, it maybe is unnecessary, but you kind of understand it. It's a security blanket for them, of course, and why not? These people bear a lot of scars from their journey up to now. And the man, Moses, who has seen them through it all, has gone off to do who knows what. He's just kind of up there somewhere in the clouds. Whatever that is. And so you can understand. Except that it all goes south. Because instead of helping people reconnect to God at this kind of precarious moment, the symbols actually start to replace God. And we know that because when they are in the presence of these symbols, their behavior changes. In fact, having this different idol in their presence seems to unleash this frenzy of behavior that God would never approve. A kind of bacchanal suddenly takes place. And so they're living the exact opposite of the life that God was going to be calling them to live in the Ten Commandments. All impulse control in this world seems to have gone out the window. And Moses, when he comes down, he sort of hustles back down the mountain to try to connect with them, to try to talk some sense into them. And, you know, he knows it's not going to be good, but even so, when he goes, he's so shocked that he drops the commandments. He gets kind of pulled into the moment, and he's furious and just goes, "Grr!" Mel Brooks fans will also remember that, you know, God comes down, Moses comes down with 15 commandments and drops them and then reduces it to 10. But the point is this anger that overcomes even Moses in his worry. But what is being depicted in these people who are in this frenzy is the Bible's version of what a life looks like when it does not have strong loyalties to anchor it anymore. And so maybe destroying the tablets was just as well, because clearly the people are not ready to take up the kind of life that the tablets are calling them to. But in the part we just read, all that's happened, okay, pretty recent. But Moses now has to think, okay, so what happens now? What do we do now? And it's a personal question for him, right? It's a personal question because, in part, he sees their failure as a reflection of his own failure to get them to be the kind of folks that he thought they were going to be, to get them to this place, to prepare them in all the ways. So what happens now? Moses knows two things that he's unwilling to trade away in this moment, this awful, awful, scary, sad moment. Angry as he is, he knows he's unwilling to trade away this people. God offers him the chance, and he says no. And he knows that he's unwilling to trade away God. And yet, even so, he cannot imagine how he will be able to be the glue that binds them together. He has nothing to offer either of them except each other, both of whom he loves and loves so deeply. It's an odd question, right? It's an odd question, I guess. But what does anyone have to offer when they have nothing to offer? When there is nothing else to trade, nothing to bargain with or bargain for, what remains? And maybe the answer is, what remains is only what our loves have made us. What remains are only those things inside us that are not means to an end, things that are expressions of the love which made us and for which we were made. What would have been left, after all, of that guy Richard on Survivor, if he'd run out of kindling too soon, maybe lost his flint while swimming, what would have been left? Only what he had allowed love to make of him. And that's what Moses has. For him, for Moses, the immensity, the sheer wonder of God are too much for mortal eyes to take in, even his. But God lifts him. The story says this. God lifts him to a sheltered place, a place in the rock, a safe vantage point from which he can see the great train of God, a kind of wondrous cape of goodness that follows after God. And from that safe place, Moses gazes out upon the countless things that come from love, none of them a means to an end, but each of them a treasure cherished in itself. And in that, there is a vision for him of a way forward. I mean, I wonder if, as he watches that great train go by, Moses sees his picture, his own face. I wonder if he sees the faces of each and every member of that stubborn and infuriating tribe he loves so dearly. I wonder if he sees the face of Richard from Survivor, or Richard Maxwell from 24 Maple. I wonder if he looks at the faces of those still in the future, even for us today, whose lives already depend on us, and whose lives depend on what our love will offer as a legacy for their safekeeping. That's what Moses sees. And that, for him, is a way of beginning again. Because that's what he wants his people to understand about God, to know in God. And that's what Jesus wants his people to understand about God and to know in God. And that's what we need to know, what we need to understand in God. There are, I suppose, moments when any one of us is called to be the glue, to be the one who receives the confusion, the hurt, the uncertainty, the anger. And there are times when we receive those things, right, and we're like, you have to blame you. You have a role in this, and yet you do not have those words. And those are not the words you need. What we need is the glue. And so we remember these moments when what it is we are finally unwilling to trade can guide us and push us. And with the help of God, bring people together once again. And so may we all render unto God what is God's. And in loving, come to see for ourselves something of God's glory. Amen.